Where does Yang Chen from Ronin Equity Partners see opportunities in today's middle market? How does a mid-market firm successfully navigate an exit in what have been choppy waters since the start of the year? And how can sponsors assess and mitigate supply chain risk across their portfolio against the background of admittedly fluctuating trade policy? We'll be discussing all of this and more in today's episode of the Private Equity Podcast by Merger Market. My name's Tom Kane. I'm Funds Editor for Merger Market in North America, and I'll be your host for today's episode, which will bring you a conversation with Yang, who's a partner at Ronin. Yang and I spoke before Monday's announcement of a US-China trade deal. Welcome, Yang. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
Well, we're speaking at a time in the market where it's certainly tumultuous. It's been an interesting couple of months. We started the year with really strong expectations for private equity, for an easier environment overall on the liquidity side, for more exits. That's been dampened somewhat amidst recent developments, notably around concerns and uncertainty related to trade tariffs. Yeah, that said, you know, how do you see the overall environment for, especially for middle market private equity?
Yeah, so I think, Tom, you're right. You know, one of the biggest challenges these days in the market has been around uncertainty, as you pointed out, around the trade tariffs. A lot of the companies are waiting for some clarity of the trade policy before they decide to sell. And then on the fund side, we're also waiting for clarity before making a decision to buy a business. I think there are few pristine assets in the market where they have either relatively vertically integrated supply chain if they're in manufacturing, or if they are in food and beverage, where most of the customers' supply chain are within the US, I think those businesses are positioned very well to sell.
Right. So talking about that, food and beverage assets with most of the customer base in the US, Ronin just announced an exit. So can you tell us a little bit about getting a deal done in this environment? Were there unique challenges, or given it was in food and beverage, was it insulated to a certain degree from what's happening in the wider market?
So yeah, for sure. I mean, our business was certainly insulated from the broader market movement to some extent because of it's in food and beverage. So we acquired this business about 3 years ago. It's interesting now to kind of look back where the business started 3 years ago and the amount of kind of work and effort we put into the business to transform it to where it is today and eventually to a successful exit. It's just been a very rewarding journey. But yeah, I mean, I think the deal went smoothly without too much interference from the market.
Okay. And so conversely to food and beverage, where are you seeing tariffs have the most impact? If you look at your wider portfolio, for example.
So I think for the most part on manufacturing businesses, typically the supply chain has been somewhat integrated. We see companies purchasing not only from China and, you know, some of the other Asian countries, but also from Europe. So that's where, you know, we had the most impact. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think on the food and beverage side of things, those supply chains are typically local, where they're sourcing from within the US and they're selling to customers within the US. So those assets have been more or less isolated.
That makes sense. And so from a middle market sponsor perspective, what things are you looking at to mitigate that supply chain risk?
We encourage all of our portfolio companies to take a closer look at their supply chain. It's more about assessing where their risks are, especially if they have a sole supplier from overseas. And usually the first step is to establish a backup supplier option, at least in some of the key categories. And then it comes down to, you know, a cost-benefit analysis, right? Is it still more cost-beneficial to import with certain tariffs at a certain degree, or is it more beneficial to insource? So it kind of becomes a case-by-case analysis for each category.
And how long does that process take?
It's different business by business. Some is easier to switch suppliers in certain other businesses because by changing up suppliers, you have to requalify for certain customer specs or certain regulatory issues. Those will take longer.
We thread it back to the exit environment. So with those discussions ongoing within, you know, middle market, you know, firms across the market, I would imagine, how is that going to weigh on exit timelines overall? Let's say you were considering exiting a business this year. But then now you have to contemplate these new criteria, this new risk. How's that going to factor your thinking? Would you put it off until you've gone through that exercise, or is it something that you can factor into an exit process?
Yeah, I think the safety around supply chain has always been a focus, even before the change in trade policy. I think back to the period during COVID where the lead times were really long and, you know, we saw a lot of price inflation on raw materials. I think at that point, we started to look at our supply chain. So for us, I think we've made a lot of progress in diversifying our supply chain across all of our businesses. In terms of exit timing, I think a lot of that will depend on market perception. With the uncertainty in the market today, a lot of PE funds are just a little hesitant to deploy capital until they have some clarity around the macro environment, which is understandable. We do see certain assets are still in the market today that are just nice, pristine assets that are really isolated from the supply chain issues, which we think that those assets will be really competitive and they will do really well. Some of our portfolio companies are certainly part of that category.
Let's segue into talking a bit about Ronin, your portfolio. So could you tell us a bit more about Ronin's strategy and how you approach the middle and lower middle market?
So I think a lot of the businesses that we look at, to your point, are in that middle market, lower middle market category. A lot of those are family or owner owned. So what we found is they know their commercial aspect of the business really well. So they know who their customers are, what the customers' needs are, and how to deliver that kind of exceptional products or services to their customers. And that's how they've been able to grow to a certain scale. But what they struggle with is once they've reached to a certain scale to grow even further, then there's a whole bunch of requirements around infrastructure, their, you know, backbone systems, data analytics, the back office team to support and take the business to the next level. So that's where we are really strong in. All of the Ronin partners have come from executive roles at businesses before. So we feel their pain point and we know how to scale a business. And it's a nice partnership where, you know, the owners and founders of the business can grow the commercial side of the business without really worrying about the backbone infrastructure. You know, for us, it's a really nice fit to help growing businesses.
That's interesting. Ronin, you guys are just saying you don't come from a middle market background. Originally, you came from, you know, large cap private equity and also blue chip corporate. So can you tell us a little bit about how that journey developed over time?
So I think personally, I started my career in mergers and acquisitions consulting, and then I moved into a blue chip corporate where I personally saw deals from both sides, right, outside in as a consultant, and then also behind the curtains as someone operating the business. So that gave us a very unique approach, both as investors and operators, understanding kind of the general macro of the market, understanding deal making, and then also behind the scene, understanding how to create value for a business. I think I speak the same for, you know, other people on our team. We all came from similar journey where, you know, we've spent half of our career in investing and then half of our career in operating businesses.
Right. And you guys met, much of the team at least met at Kraft Heinz, correct?
That's correct.
What do you take from that experience into the kind of investments you're making in today's market in those lower and middle market companies?
So I think Kraft Heinz was known for their hyper focus on cost and also using the zero-based budgeting approach to change the cost structure of the business. I think that still influenced us to some extent as we go into businesses post-close, encouraging businesses and management team to re-examine their cost structure and make sure every dollar spent is generating some sort of return and is not wasted because historically the company has always done it. And then from there, then is really taking those dollars and resources that are freed up through this exercise and put it back into the business so that we can further grow the business. So, I mean, that philosophy still is with us as we look at each portfolio company.
Tell us a little bit about how you've source deals, because a lot of the investments you've made today involve bringing together multiple acquisitions at once, you know, sometimes three, even more. And I think that was the case as well with Hartisan, which you just exited. So how do you go about that? What are some of the challenges in finding those, and how does it all come about?
So I think typically for us, we develop a thesis around a certain sector or certain industry over time. And then throughout the process, we'll find and meet different businesses, either through an auction process, through a bank, or on a proprietary basis through connections of ours. And then it takes us time to kind of build that thesis before we can execute a deal. I think a lot of times you will find in those kind of smaller middle market sized businesses, there are certain aspects of the business that makes almost a standalone deal very difficult. One good example of that is usually customer concentration. The business could have a very large customer that's more than 50% of their customer base or revenue base, which typically on a standalone basis, a lot of people will think that's too risky. But when you're combining multiple businesses at once, then it's a nice asset where the customer concentration gets blended down to an acceptable level. Other cases are, you know, sometimes you see a business that could be a strong platform with a really nice leadership team in place, with a really nice system in place, and others don't. So it's really about finding those opportunities that make sense as a combined business.
Well, I think that's really interesting. One thing that we don't talk about, I think, enough, in my opinion, when it comes to M&A, and I imagine certainly for companies in that bracket of the market, is the cultural element as well. How do you manage that? How do you manage bringing together different businesses, different cultures, and bringing them together to create a new culture, I guess, or to build on that existing culture? Is that something that you guys consider in addition to the financial and operational elements?
For sure. I think it starts with us, and it starts with the leadership team that we put in place, making sure it's not just an operational fit, but also a cultural fit. I think the other part that we usually do is when we acquire a business, understanding the current state of their culture and where some of the employee pain points are, so that, you know, on day one, we can take actions to address those. But for sure, I think integrating businesses coming from kind of different background, different culture, it has certainly been a challenge. But, you know, the key to that is to not make sudden changes overnight, but to understand the people, their pain points, their needs, and then slowly address those to make improvements.
That's really interesting. I think I'm particularly interested in that cultural dimension when it comes to M&A. Another feature I wanted to talk to you about of Ronin's setup is you partner with family offices significantly. So how does that provide flexibility? I mean, how do you see opportunities within the family office landscape overall, I guess, especially in a tougher fundraising environment? If you look across middle market private equity, I often hear about family offices. When I speak to GPs, they want to get more access to family offices. It's something that you guys do a lot. So can you talk us a little bit through, you know, how you approach that and just the landscape overall for family offices?
Yeah, I think definitely working with family offices provides a lot of flexibility. And perhaps the biggest one is around the holding periods. Most family offices, they don't have a very strict mandate of how many years they can hold an investment, which gives us a lot of the flexibility really to do what's right for the business, especially in the current environment where, you know, the market is nervous about uncertainty, about tariff policies and things like that. And to your point earlier, it could potentially push a deal timeline out a little bit just based on market perception, but partnering with family offices give us the flexibility to do that.
And how big is the family office opportunity in your view for middle market firms?
I think the family office space are slowly starting to shift their focus into the middle market space, just because, you know, as you look at some of the large cap deals, things get really competitive and obviously it hurts your return, you know, if you have to bid very aggressively from a pricing perspective. So I think a lot of people start to realize middle market, lower middle market has most of the opportunities, and that's why a lot of the dollars are starting to shift to funds like Ronin.
So I'd like to ask you about your own career as well, your own journey. So how did you, you mentioned you started in consulting, you've worked for Kraft Heinz, among others too. What inspired you to pursue a career ultimately in private equity?
I think it's having that exposure to deals from both sides, either from, you know, outside in or behind the curtain. I was fortunate enough to see how quickly PE ownership can change a business and create value over a very short period of time for really everybody involved in the system. You're really talking about how do you make a better business in 3 to 5 years, and that will help employees, they'll help management, they'll help, you know, your investors and lenders, everybody involved in the system to really generate value. That was just fascinating for me.
And I imagine the landscape's evolved since you got your start in private equity. So what are some of the biggest changes you've noticed in that time frame, would you say, over the last 5, 10 years or so?
So I think historically, even when we started, you know, the large cap leverage buyout type of opportunities were very attractive in the market. And then over time, the focus has shifted to some of the smaller opportunities, but in unique end markets or sectors of the market.
And so can you compare and contrast a little bit? So doing a large cap deal as you did earlier in your career to now executing some of the lower middle market founder and family owned type deals that we've discussed. I mean, what are some of the key differences you got to take into account when executing?
Yeah, it's actually quite different. I think for large cap deals, usually those are very mature business that has like all the systems in place, that have a full management team in place. And a lot of times when we were at Kraft Heinz and some of the larger deals we did, it was more about, hey, can we make the business more efficient and more profitable by looking at the cost structure of the business? I think on the smaller, lower middle market side of the things, it's really more about building on top of what the business already has, whether it's team, whether it's system, is processes, and what have you, to be able to further grow the business. Because, you know, the business is just at a different phase of its journey, where we see a lot more opportunity to generate outsized return. But obviously, it's also a lot more work from that perspective, because you're basically in the business owner's shoes and trying to generate value from all aspects of the business in a very short period of time.
Makes sense. I'd like to ask you also about how you see the role of women in private equity. You know, what are some of the biggest challenges you've faced yourself? And you know, how do you see that evolving in that time frame as well, which we've just discussed?
To be honest, you know, it's no secret that, you know, private equity has historically been a very male-dominated space. I think even to some extent today, I think for me as a woman, the most important part has always been, gender aside, trying to offer my unique perspective, add value so that the team as a group can make better decisions. I think over the years, you know, we've seen more and more women taking leadership roles, either as executives of a business, as founders of a business, or, you know, serving as board members or operating advisors. So that's a great trend to see, but hopefully more and more women can join and this trend can continue over the future.
And so what advice would you give to women aspiring to enter private equity at this moment?
Gender aside, I've always believed that, you know, the first step to any successful career is to do what you do exceptionally well. You know, whether it's just a simple task or a simple project, let's say build a model. I mean, you can build it well and like easy for other people to use so that the next time when similar projects come along, people will think of you and pull you in so that you start to build your own reputation and personal brand that will open up more opportunities to you in the future.
Yeah, and I think, you know, gender aside, it's a constantly evolving landscape, as we've just discussed. So imagine it's also important for anyone to keep on top of innovations and market developments. You know, how do you keep on top of that generally?
A couple of different avenues through our portfolio companies. We are naturally exposed to different conferences, trade shows, industry researches, and things like that to keep us on top of the big industry trends that we're seeing, at least in the areas that we're investing in. And then just always be open to new ideas as they come along. I mean, we do see macro trends playing out in the market, especially in the food and beverage space. So kind of playing into those trends and finding businesses you can help and play into those trends as well to invest in, I think that has been the focus for us.
Well, fantastic. Well, on that note, Yang, I'd like to thank you for joining the podcast today. Really insightful discussion. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here and hopefully was able to offer some help.
Brilliant. Thank you, listener, for tuning in. So if you like the podcast, please don't forget to subscribe on Apple or Spotify or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you again in the next episode.